Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, this is Denise, reading to you the Wednesday, March 27th, 2024 edition of the Cape Cod Times. We begin with the weather. Today, a high of 53 with a low of 45, cloudy, milder, showers in the PM. On Thursday, a high of 50 with a low of 43, periods of rain. On Friday, periods of rain, breezy in the afternoon, a high of 49 with a low of 36. On Saturday, sunny, a high of 52 with a low of 36. And on Easter Sunday, partly sunny, a high of 49 with a low of 36. The sun will rise today at 6:32 a.m., set at 7:01 p.m. for a total of 12 hours and 29 minutes of daylight. In the lottery, the numbers game dated Tuesday, March 26th, midday. 9-4-6-7. Again, 9-4-6-7. The numbers game evening, 1-4-8-9. Again, 1-4-8-9. Mass cash for Tuesday, March 26th. 5-14-16-18-30. Again, 5-14-16-18-30. Mega Millions for Tuesday, March 26th. 7-11-22-29-38. With a Mega Millions ball of 4. Again, 7-11-22-29-38. With a Mega Millions ball of 4. And Lucky for Life, dated Tuesday, March 26th. 18-25-34-39-48, with a lucky ball of 12. Again, 18-25-34-39-48, with a lucky ball of 12. On the front page, Deep Sea Discovery. Falmouth submersible pilot spots new worm species, which now bears his name, by Heather McCarron, Cape Cod Times, USA Today Network. As the lead pilot for the deep-sea submersible, Alvin, Falmouth resident Bruce Strickrat already has a claim to fame. He's one of just 45 people who's driven the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution-operated vehicle since it launched in 1964. Now the 28-year Alvin veteran has the added distinction of having a new species of deep-sea worms named after him. Called Pessinaris strickrati, the worm were first spotted in 2009 and again in 2018 near a methane seep in the Pacific Ocean about 30 miles off Costa Rica. They were finally confirmed and announced as a new species in a study published in the science research journal PLOS One on March 6th. Strickrat was literally the driver behind the discovery, shuttling researchers more than a half a mile to the sea floor to study the marine life around the seep, an area where methane escapes the sea floor in the form of gas bubbles. He was one of the first, along with California-based marine biologist and study leader Greg Roos, to get a fleeting glance at the worms during the 2009 dive about 3,280 feet below the surface. Rouse of UC San Diego's Scripps Institution of Oceanography gave Strickrat's name to the new species in recognition of his role in its discovery. "I'm honored that Greg saw fit to name this after me. It means a lot," said Strickrat, speaking recently by phone from the mid-Pacific at another study site along the East Pacific Rise, just north of the equator. "I think it's the representative of how the program and the technology help scientists get to places they wouldn't be able to go to without Alvin." A first encounter with the sea worm. He recalled the first encounter with the newest sea worm species in 2009 when he and Rouse spotted two of the worms during a dive. "We didn't know what they were. We just saw these creatures sort of hovering about 6 feet off the bottom. They were long and skinny," he said. The worms were difficult to see, and Strickhart said he tried to nudge Alvin in for a closer look, but as he humorously says, it's hard to creep in a submarine, and so off the worms went. The researcher, whose work was supported by the National Science Foundation, saw another to suspect they might have witnessed something new to science. It wasn't until 2018 when the researchers returned to Costa Rica's methane seeps with Strickhart once again at the helm of the U.S. Navy-owned submersible that they again encountered the creatures. This time they saw several individual worms. They were not nearly as skittish as the first time, he said, explaining they were likely in reproductive mode. Move like a magic carpet. As they did the first time, Strickhart said the worms' graceful way of moving struck him as unique. He'd seen other sea worms move in a twisting motion, almost like a helix. In contrast, Strickhart's worms undulate. These really move like a magic carpet, he said. During that dive, Strickhart became the first to capture live specimens for closer study using a five-chambered vacuum canister device on Alvin known as the slurp gun. It can be a delicate operation that requires some skillful maneuvering. We work with some really complex equipment, and it's a 23-foot submarine that you're pirouetting around in, he said. There are times when it's frustrating. Getting these really fine samples doesn't always go the way you want. The team also captured images and video of worms, evidence they use in proving them to be members of a previously undiscovered species, a process that can take years and DNA analysis and comparing it to known species. A 4-inch long member of the ragworm family, Strickhart's worm is a 4-inch long member of the ragworm family, a group of about 500 species of segmented, mostly marine worms that look like a cross between a centipede and an earthworm. They have elongated bodies with rows of bristled appendages called parapodia on their sides and a hidden set of pincer-shaped jaws that can be extended for feeding. It's not the first time a new species has been named for a pilot of Alvin, which will officially mark 6 decades of discovery this June. Past pilot Dudley Foster had a new comb jelly named for him in the late 1970s, and Paul Tibbetts helped collect a new species of Pacific mussel in the late 1980s, resulting in that naming. The worm is not the first new species to bear Strickhart's name. In 2007, another new species discovered in the southern part of the East Pacific Rise was named Epiretus strickharti. If you go to Wikipedia, you'll find Strickhart's hagfish, which is basically an animal that eats dead fish. He said, adding the last part of my name is rot, so it works for me. With the ragworm, Strickhart said now he has one that's an invertebrate and one that's a vertebrate. At the Costa Rican methane seeps, according to Hui, Rouse and other researchers have observed about 450 species at the Costa Rican methane seeps since 2009, with Strickhart's ragworm bringing the number of species that were new to science to 48. Rouse said these stats underscore how much more there is left to learn about the inhospitable deep-sea ecosystems and their biological importance. We've spent years trying to name and describe the biodiversity of the deep sea. At this point, we have found more new species than we have time to name and describe. It just shows how much undiscovered biodiversity is out there. Strickhart said it's inspiring to be a part of the discoveries. The life down there is teeming. It's just mind-blowing. It's proven that life is persistent. If there's energy, if there's resources, it's going to take advantage. It's a pretty special experience to go down there and go down with experts. I'm an engineer, yet I'm getting trained by the best by being there and talking to them. It's a joy to be a part of it. Besides Rouse, other contributors to the Strickhart ragworm study include Sonia Hook, Avery Hiley, and Ekin Tyliak of Scripps. Tulio Velabosguero of Centro de Investigación is the study's first and conducted the primary anatomical analysis. The next front page story. Tragedy in Baltimore. Bridge collapses after hit from ship by Charles Ventura, Theo Nguyen, Susan Miller, and Christopher Can, USA Today, Baltimore. A massive search effort was underway Tuesday for 6 construction workers who were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore when it was struck by a large cargo vessel and collapsed into the Patapisco River, shutting down a critical artery for East Coast shipping. Around 1:30 a.m., a vessel leaving the port of Baltimore struck the Key Bridge, causing it to collapse in matters of seconds. Officials said the crew warned of a power issue and sent out a mayday before the collision. Footage of the incident shows the cargo ship smashed into one of the columns before the bridge snapped, hit the water, and partially fell on the ship, where a burst of flames and smoke could be seen rising into the night sky. Several vehicles were on the bridge at the time of impact and were plunged into the river, which was measured Tuesday at temperatures cold enough to cause hypothermia. There were also contractors on the bridge repairing potholes, said Maryland Transportation Secretary Paul Whitefield. So far, two people have been rescued. One was unharmed and the other remains in very serious condition. The University of Maryland Medical Center's Trauma Center treated one patient from the collapse who has been discharged. Michael Schwartzberg, the medical center spokesperson, said in an email. Schwartzberg declined to say more about the person's injuries, citing patient privacy concerns. Multiple local, state, and federal agencies are coordinating the search, which spans a vast section of the river, both above and below the surface of the water, and the ship itself, said James Wallace, chief of Baltimore City Fire Department. Divers, helicopters, and sonar technology were being used and had located several vehicles submerged in the river, which is about 50 feet deep where the bridge collapsed. The crew that was on the ship when it collided with the bridge remained on the vessel, which needed to be assessed for damage before rescuers could board it, said Wallace. The vessel was carrying cargo for the major shipping company Maersk and was scheduled to arrive in Sri Lanka early next month. A senior U.S. official told USA Today that the ship apparently lost power a few minutes before striking the bridge. Authorities have not stated an official cause for the crash, but Maryland Governor Wes Moore said in a news conference the crew notified authorities of a power issue as it was traveling about 9 miles per hour. He said the crash seems to be an accident and added that the bridge was up to code. Moore said once the mayday was issued, officials on site stopped cars from coming over the bridge. These people are heroes, he said. They saved lives last night. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott issued a local state of emergency, saying in a post on X, "Our teams are mobilizing resources and working swiftly to address this crisis and ensure the safety and well-being of our community." Moore declared a state of emergency earlier Tuesday and said he was working with an interagency team to quickly deploy federal resources from the Biden administration. President Joe Biden has been briefed on the collapse and the ongoing search and rescue efforts, the White House said, adding that he will continue to receive updates from his team. The container vessel called the Dolly was chartered by the major shipping company Maersk and was carrying its cargo, according to a statement from the company. When it crashed into the bridge, no Maersk crew and personnel were on board the vessel, which is operated by charter vessel company Synergy Group and owned by Singapore-based Grace Ocean PTE. We are horrified by what has happened in Baltimore, and our thoughts are with all of those affected. We are closely following the investigations conducted by authorities and Synergy, and we will do our utmost to keep our customers informed. Synergy Marine Corps said the Dolly collided with one of the pillars of the bridge and that all of its crew members, including two pilots, have been accounted for, and there were no reports of injuries. U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Aaron Palmer said at a news conference Tuesday that the agencies remain focused on search and rescue. She did not comment on the crew, the ship, or provide additional information and details about the collision. All vessel traffic in and out of the Port of Baltimore was suspended until further notice. But the port remained still open for truck transports, Whitefield said. Traffic was being diverted from the area around the Key Bridge. This does not mean the Port of Baltimore is shut down. We are still processing trucks inside of our terminals. But Bloomberg reported that the port looks to be out of commission indefinitely. At least 40 ships are now more or less trapped inside the port, according to Reuters. At least 30 other ships planned to arrive there. They will likely have to reroute shipping to other ports on the East Coast, said Kevin Linderman, a professor and supply chain expert at Pennsylvania State University. However, this will put an additional demand on these ports, and shippers may not be able to access U.S. markets as efficiently. The Francis Scott Key Bridge, named for the author of the Star-Spangled Banner, is a 1.6-mile, four-lane bridge, according to Maryland Transportation Authority. It opened in 1977. The span is the outermost of three major river crossings at Baltimore Harbor, according to the American Civil Engineering Society. The steel-arched bridge, with a total length of 8,636 feet, was the second longest continuous truss bridge span in the world when it was built and remains the second longest in the nation and third in the world, according to the society. Vessels crash into a bridge draws attention at Cape Maritime School, Cape Cod Times, USA Today Network, Buzzards Bay. Officials from Massachusetts Maritime Academy gathered midday Tuesday to discuss with media representatives the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. The presentation was intended to be informative, to generally give a sense of what it would look like from the bridge for a ship coming in or out of the port of a large city. The school's executive director of the Maritime Center for Responsible Energy, Captain Mike Burns, spoke to the media inside school's bridge. The backdrop of the simulator was the Verrazano Narrows Bridge in New York City. The discussion was also generally about training involved to become a Master Marine and international safety standards, said Elizabeth Simmons, who is Vice President of External Affairs at the State University. What do we know about the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge? A cargo ship struck a column of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which carried the major highway Interstate 695 over the Patapsco River around 1:30 a.m. Tuesday. The bridge collapsed within seconds of the strike. The ship sent out a mayday before the collision, giving officials time to stop cars from driving onto the bridge, according to USA Today. As of Tuesday afternoon, crews were still searching for construction workers believed to be on the bridge when it collapsed. Has a ship ever hit a Cape Cod bridge? Yes, in October of 2016, a cruise ship clipped the Buzzards Bay Railroad Bridge, but the collision was not the same magnitude as the Baltimore Bridge strike early Tuesday. The Cape Cod Bridge, which stands 135 feet above the water, was scraped by an antenna atop the Viking Star, a 131-foot-tall Norwegian cruise ship. Some paint was lost, but all three Cape Cod bridges were inspected after the incident and found undamaged, according to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at the time. AAA expect busy roads as people travel to see eclipse, by Seth Jacobson, Wicked Local, USA Today Network. If you're planning on traveling north to check out the complete solar eclipse on April 8th, you should make your plans soon, because AAA is forecasting busy roads that week. The eclipse falls on a Monday, so many travelers will make a long weekend of the event, with Saturday, April 6th expected to be a busy travel day. AAA said in a written statement sent to Wicked Local, AAA's car rental partner Hertz reports a 3,000% increase over this time last year in advance bookings for eclipse path cities for that Saturday. The eclipse also overlaps with spring break for many families across the U.S., so there will be even more travelers than usual on the move that weekend. Not only is AAA warning people about traffic on the roads that week, the agency also stated AAA booking data show hotels in the most popular cities along the path of totality are 48% more expensive during the eclipse weekend than they were that same time last year. Tim Brothers, technical instructor and observatory manager at the MIT Wallace Astrophysical Observatory in Westford, told Wicked Local earlier this month that while you won't be able to see a total eclipse from Massachusetts on April 8th, you could witness it in its entirety from many areas that are not so far away. While the entirety of New England will experience the solar eclipse on April 8th, if you want to see the totality of the total solar eclipse, you need to be within the path, Brothers told Wicked Local at the time. Fortunately, this path covers much of northern and western New England, including New York, although it does not pass over Massachusetts. If you do make it to the path of totality, expect the eclipse to start shortly after 2 p.m., the totality will start after 3 p.m., and the eclipse itself will conclude after 4:30 p.m. Among the places where viewers can be in the path of totality, where they can see a total eclipse, include Burlington, Vermont, Lancaster, New Hampshire, and Caribou, Maine, according to NASA. Where you pick your spot within the path will dictate how long you experience the totality, Brothers told Wicked Local earlier this March. This will range from roughly 2 minutes at the edges to about 3.5 minutes in the center of the path. Fortunately, the path will be roughly 100 miles wide. Brothers mentioned, at the time, one potential fly in the ointment. The trick will be whether the weather cooperates. Clouds in April are obviously common, and statistics show we should expect a 70% chance of clouds. To increase your chance of seeing it, you would have to travel farther south, where Texas and Mexico are the least likely to experience a cloudy day. When it comes to viewing the solar eclipse, Brothers said it's imperative to have the right equipment. He said the gear known as eclipse glasses should be from eclipse.aas.org. He added that the next chance to see a total solar eclipse in the U.S. is in about 20 years, on August 23rd, 2044. In the Cape and Islands section, New Cape Cod Preschool to Focus Native Culture and Language by Rachel Devaney, Cape Cod Times, USA Today Network. For years, sketched plans of a Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal childcare facility have been just that, plans. It's been in the works for a while, said Mashpee Wampanoag Education Department's childcare manager, Eileen Miranda. Now at last, thanks to $1 million in federal money the tribe received this month, the 6,650-square-foot facility will take shape. We are thrilled to death, having gone through COVID and suffered the consequences of cost increases and delay after delay, said Mashpee Wampanoag Education Department Director Roxanne Mills Brown. If all goes well, construction will begin in June. The money for this facility was a part of a $3 million federal funding package that was designated for energy and water resources, housing and urban development, and science. The fund supported 5 community-based projects across Cape Cod and the islands, according to a press release from the offices of Senator Edward Markey and Senator Elizabeth Warren. These investments in early education, marine research, and harbor infrastructure will make a meaningful difference in the lives of residents, said Markey in a press release. The tribe currently runs Wheatamu School, which is a Wampanoag Montessori school, which prepares preschool and early elementary students for community leadership, according to the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe website. But the childcare facility will take early learning to a new and dynamic level, said Mills Brown. The childcare facility, said Mills Brown, will include floor classrooms, a multi-purpose room, built-in kitchenettes, an infant-toddler room, and a preschool for 35 children. The entire $1 million will be devoted to construction and connected to other costs. The facility will also be built on tribal trust land, said Mills Brown, that will enable teachers to go beyond state standards care and infuse education with Wampanoag cultural and language programs. We want to nurture positive social and academic development of tribal youth and deepen children's understanding of accurate tribal history. That's really important to us. In 2015, the federal government declared 150 acres in Mashpee and 170 acres of land in Taunton as the tribe's initial reservation on which the tribe can exercise its full sovereignty rights, according to the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe's website. Safety and health standards will also be at the highest standards, quality, and expectation. The preschool's enrollment will give preferences to Wampanoag children, but the school could open its doors to non-native children. It would depend on enrollment, she said. We do need to be able to fulfill capacities to sustain programming and staff. If there are vacancies, we would potentially open up to non-native families. It was rigorous work to complete 2 grant applications for one of Markey's office and another for Warren's office. Each Senate office had different requirements, and it took about a month to get it all done. It was definitely a crunch time. For Mills Brown, it's exciting to be able to move forward. The earliest that construction will be completed is late spring or early summer of 2025. We are working with Collaborative Education Services on developing curriculum and ensuring that we have a program ready and available once the doors open. Additional funding for construction completion and program development will come from the Administration for Children and Families, or ACF, which is a division of the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, said Miranda. We receive about $2.7 million annually through the ACF, said Miranda. We have been getting that chunk of money since 2018. Next up from the Cape and Islands section, two running for 3rd Barnstable District seat by Jeanette Hinkle, Cape Cod Times, USA Today Network. The House seat for the 3rd Barnstable District representing Bourne, Falmouth, and Mashpee is up for election this year. The primary election is September 3rd, and the general election is November 5th. The deadline to register to vote, update your voter registration, or change your party is 10 days before any election. As of March 18th, two people are running for the seat. David Vieira, an incumbent Republican from Falmouth, and Kathy Fox Alfano, a Democratic challenger from Bourne. During the last election, issues that drove voters to the polls included water quality and environmental protection, development of affordable and workforce housing, and education. Catherine Gallagher, chairperson of the Mashpee Democratic Town Committee, said cost of living, including the affordability of childcare and housing, will remain a top issue during this year's race. People who work in Mashpee should be able to afford to live in Mashpee. Yet when people see the homes that are being built, they see they are not for the people who grew up and work here. Democrats, she said, are looking to elect a representative who is present and willing to meet with us and hear our concerns. Among those concerns are the cost of Mashpee's sewer overhaul for homeowners. We'd like to see the state offering help to families who need it to hook up to sewer as it is finished and as they do for those who need help with septic systems. Ed Stadelman, chair of the Falmouth Republican Town Committee, said that while Falmouth Republicans have opposed efforts to run offshore wind infrastructure through town, local GOP meetings have been dominated by fears that migration will negatively affect Cape towns. That is the hot topic and leading issue right now. Overwhelmingly, Stadelman said, the state representative elected Stadelman said should focus on cutting funding to sanctuary cities. What towns or areas does this seat cover? The position represents Bourne, Falmouth, and Mashpee. What does the person elected to this seat do? The Massachusetts House of Representatives is comprised of 160 members, each representing a district of approximately 40,000 people. As required by the Massachusetts Constitution, the House may not adjourn itself for more than 2 days, meeting year-round in either formal or informal session, to introduce, consider, and vote on legislation. How much does it pay? Massachusetts legislative salaries in 2023 started at $73,655 per year, plus $15,000 to $20,000 for expenses, depending on how far they live in Boston. According to National Conference of State Legislatures, legislators in leadership roles receive more pay. How often are elections? State legislators in both the House and Senate serve in their roles for 2 years. All seats are up for election in years that end with an even number. Who is the incumbent? Vieira took office in 2011. Before his time as a state legislator, he worked as a deputy sheriff in emergency management. Vieira is currently the ranking House member of both the Joint Committee on Bonding, Capital Expenditures, and State Assets, and the Joint Committee on Public Safety and Homeland Security. He also serves on the Joint Committee on COVID-19 and Emergency Preparedness and Management, and the Joint Committee on Tourism, Arts, and Cultural Development. He's also the founding member of the Massachusetts Military Asset and Security Strategy Task Force. So far, who has filed papers to run for the job? How much money do they have in their campaign as of the latest date? Both Vieira and Alfano have said they plan to run for the seat. Alfano, a New York native who spent most of her career working for companies including CBS and Polaroid, is now a realtor with Kinlan Grover Compass in North Falmouth. This will be Alfano's second run at the seat after entering the race in late 2022. According to the Massachusetts Office of Campaign and Political Finance, Vieira's campaign had $6,672 in cash on hand in 2024, while Alfano's campaign had $4,910. we've reached the halfway point of today's reading of the Cape Cod Times, dated Wednesday, March 27th. It's time for the obituaries. Jared F. Lynch of Kitiwit. Jared Jerry Lynch, husband, father, and grandfather, passed away peacefully at home on March 18, 2024. Born November 27, 1939, he is survived by his wife of 50 years, Elizabeth Smith Lynch, and many other loved ones and family. Jerry graduated from Cathedral High School in Boston and studied in a postgraduate technical drawing design program. Jerry was a U.S. Air Force veteran. Following his discharge from the Air Force, he worked as a professional photographer. He also worked for iTech and Benthos. He loved hunting, fishing, and being on the water from his early years. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to St. Jude's Children's Hospital, his favorite charity, or to the charity of your choice. Visitation will be at 10 a.m. at Chapman Funeral Home, 3778 Falmouth Road, Marston's Mills, followed by a funeral mass at Our Lady of Assumption Catholic Church in Osterville at 11 a.m. Burial will be at the Massachusetts National Cemetery in Bourne at 1245 p.m. The next obituary, Nancy Jean Van Putten Clark of Kitiwit. Nancy Jean Clark Van Putten, gone far too soon, 69, of Kitiwit, passed away peacefully on March 23rd at the McCarthy Care Center in Sandwich. She was the beloved and cherished wife of Stephen J. Clark of 47 years. Nancy was predeceased by her parents. In lieu of flowers, it would be greatly appreciated by the family to send donations in Nancy's memory to the V&A of Cape Cod McCarthy Care Center or the animal charity of your choice. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, April 3rd in Mosswood Cemetery, Kitiwit. Arrangements under the direction of Chapman Funerals and Cremations, Marston's Mills. The next, Rebecca H. Whiting of Orleans. Rebecca H. Whiting, 86, passed away peacefully at Cape Cod Hospital on March 6th with loved ones by her side. Rebecca was born on September 3rd, 1937, to the late Robert and Viola Morris of Truro. She is predeceased by her husband, George R. Whitings. She is survived by other loved ones and family. Rebecca, also known as Becky, graduated from Provincetown High School. She attended art classes at Castle Hill School of Art in her youth and spent decades honing her skills with oil painting, becoming an accomplished and renowned artist. She leaves behind a legacy of masterpieces to be cherished for years to come. A private ceremony will be held at a later date. For online condolences, please visit nickersonfunerals.com. Back to our stories. U.S. Supreme Court mulling limits on abortion drug. By Maureen Gropp, Bart Jansen, Aisha Bigchi, Savannah Kutcher, Ann Sibley, Mays Osterman, USA Today, Washington. Supreme Court justices on Tuesday sounded skeptical that anti-abortion doctors have the ability to challenge the Food and Drug Administration's rule for a common abortion drug, raising the possibility that the court could dismiss a case that threatened to sharply limit access to mifepristone. 2 years after overturning Roe v. Wade, the justices were asked to consider whether to roll back FDA decisions, loosening restrictions on how mifepristone can be prescribed and dispensed. Anti-abortion doctors are seeking to curb the availability of the drug that was used in nearly two-thirds of U.S. abortions last year, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. Both justices on both sides of the court's ideological divide pressed for evidence that a physician had been forced to violate their conscience by treating a patient suffering from side effects. Justice Neil Gorsuch said the case seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action. Much of the nearly 2 hours of oral arguments focused on that issue rather than on whether the FDA properly relaxed restrictions after the drug had been available for over two decades. Standing to sue. The Supreme Court could dismiss the case outright if a majority of justices don't think the challenges have a legitimate basis to sue. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preglegar argued Tuesday that two doctors in the case don't have standing because they don't prescribe the drug, and religious freedom protections means they wouldn't have to treat the rare patients who have an emergency reaction. Justices Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch, all appointees of former President Donald Trump, probed whether the doctor's objections to medications abortions could be solved by anti-abortion doctors simply asserting a conscience objection to certain treatments rather than a sweeping judgment affecting nationwide access. Aaron M. Hawley, the attorney for the anti-abortion doctors challenging Mifepristone, said the existing conscience objection is not good enough because doctors may not know until they scrub in for an emergency whether the situation is a miscarriage, an ectopic pregnancy, or an elective abortion. By then, there's no time to object, she said. There are life-threatening situations. But justices repeatedly asked for evidence that such a situation has happened. Safety questions. A wide swath of government agencies and outside experts have said that the drug first approved in 2000 is safer than common drugs such as Tylenol and Viagra. Anti-abortion groups challenging Mifepristone questions those studies and argue that the FDA ignored contrary data. Preglegar argued the courts have no business second-guessing FDA experts about which drugs are safe. Moreover, she said, there are multiple ways any safety issue could be addressed. The FDA takes seriously its responsibility to ensure safety and conducts ongoing surveillance, making adjustments as needed, she said. The drug makers are also responsible at all times and can be sued for adverse reactions. So if the premise here is that unsafe drugs could somehow remain on the market, Preligar said, I think that's incorrect. Hawley said adverse consequences connected to Mifepristone abortions were common, more common than the other side claimed. Justice Samuel Alito questioned the manufacturer's profit motive. If the court's restriction on the FDA is limited, Danko Laboratories is going to sell more, he said. Do you think the FDA is infallible? Jessica Ellsworth, a lawyer for Danko, said drugs have certainly been withdrawn after approval, which is why manufacturers continue tracking reactions to their products. Two of the court's most conservative justices, Alito and Clarence Thomas, raised the issue of whether a 19th century obscenity law prevents Mifepristone from being dispensed through the mail. Some abortion opponents are promoting the Comstock Act as a de facto federal abortion ban that just needs enforcing. Both Preglegar and Ellsworth said the FDA wasn't required to consider that law. Ellsworth also noted that the Comstock Act hasn't been enforced for nearly 100 years. Nationwide remedies. Chief Justice John Roberts and Gorsuch raised concerns, as they have in other cases, about district courts issuing judgments that cover entire country, as happened in the Mifepristone case, rather than just their own geographic jurisdictions. Roberts asked why the case couldn't be limited to people involved in one region rather than blocking the FDA from allowing the drug everywhere. I think it might be impractical, Hawley said, because the FDA regulation would remain in place and permit things like mail order abortions. In addition, she said, nationwide remedies are often needed so that everyone is treated the same. Protests outside the court. People began gathering Monday night for protests that sometimes became heated. Early Tuesday morning, calls by one protester said the abortion is essential, overlapped with chants by Students for Life members saying, "We are the pro-life generation and we will abolish abortion." Ronald Quirk, 65, held a sign reading "Supreme Tyranny." The father of a 24-year-old daughter, Quirk said he came from nearby Arlington, Virginia, because he feels the justices have made women second-class citizens. No U.S. citizen should have rights taken away, and that's what they did last year with Dobbs, and now they're trying to do again. And where is it going to stop, he said. As the legal arguments began inside, conflict escalated outside. Shame on you for what you do, one protester holding a sign reading "anti-racist, anti-capitalist, anti-fascist, anti-abortion pills" shouted at an abortion rights demonstrator who held white plastic coat hangers stained with red paint. A group of demonstrators shouting "abortion is health care" attempted to drown out the opposing crowd. A block away, Capitol Police arrested almost a dozen members of the Women's March protest for civil disobedience. Trump's media company soars in early trading by Bailey Schultz, USA Today. Donald Trump's social media platform is now trading on the stock market. The parent company of Truth Social, Trump Media and Technology Group went public Tuesday morning under the ticker DJT, short for Donald J. Trump. The stock was trading at about $67 early Tuesday afternoon, up 33%. The public listing was made possible by Trump's media merger with Digital World Acquisition, a special purpose acquisition company, or SPAC. Digital World shareholders voted in favor of the merger Friday, and Trump Media took Digital World's place on the NASDAQ on Tuesday. Before trading open, Tuesday's Truth Social's parent company had a market value of about $6.8 billion. Because Trump owns about 79 million of the 135 million outstanding shares, his stake in the company was worth about $4 billion. It's a pricey valuation, especially for a company that has lost tens of millions of dollars since 2021 launch and generated just over $3 million in revenue during the first 9 months of 2023. The valuation of the business is a rich relative to its underlying fundamentals, but I would not get in front of it in the near term, Thomas Hayes, chairman of Great Hill Capital, told Reuters. This valuation may be more of a proxy on the enthusiasm of supporters for Trump than a reasonable estimate of underlying business prospects. Trump is not allowed to sell his shares or use them as collateral for a bond for the next 6 months. He would need approval from the Trump Media Board to lift that restriction. Trump must post a $175 million bond as he appeals the full $454 million civil fraud judgment against him. He has also been ordered to pay in $83.8 million after a defamation trial loss to advice columnist E. Jean Carroll. Truth Social's ticker DJT was likely picked because research shows that familiar names such as a former president's initials can help a company's stock performance. One study from Pomona College in 2019 verified earlier research that found clever tickers tend to perform better, partly because they are more memorable to investors. The next story. Sick cattle in two states test positive for bird flu, by Natalie Nasa-Alund, USA Today. Sick dairy cattle in two states have tested positive for bird flu, federal officials said Monday. As of Monday, the highly contagious pathogenic avian influenza virus, HPAI, have been found in unpasteurized clinical samples of milk from ill cows at two dairy farms in Kansas and one in Texas, as well as a swab from another dairy cow in Texas. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced in a press release. The agency said its officials, along with the Food and Drug Administration Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and state veterinary and public health officials, are investigating. Wild migratory birds are believed to be the source of the infection, the USDA wrote, and viral testing and epidemiologic efforts are continuing. Additional testing took place Friday and over the weekend. The USDA reported because farms are also have reported finding dead wild birds on their properties. Based on findings from Texas, the agency wrote in the release, the detections appear to have been introduced by wild birds and the commercial milk supply remains safe, both due to federal animal health requirements and pasteurization. USDA, low risk to humans. The Texas Animal Health Commission confirmed the flu virus is the type AH5N1 strain known for decades to cause outbreaks in birds and to occasionally affect people. The virus, the state agency said, is affecting older dairy cows in Texas and Kansas, as well as cattle in New Mexico, causing symptoms including decreased lactation and low appetite. Initial testing by the National Veterinary Services Laboratories has not found changes to the virus that would make it more transmissible to humans, which means the risk of the public contracting the virus remains low for now, the USDA said. Federal and state agencies said they are moving quickly to conduct additional bird flu testing. The first detection of HPAI in dairy cattle in Texas and Kansas underscores the importance of adherence to biosecurity measures. Vigilance in the monitoring for disease and immediately involving your veterinarian when something seems off. AMVA President Dr. Rena Carlson said, a complete evaluation, including the collection and submission of laboratory samples and reporting to state animal health officials when appropriate and in a timely fashion, are incredibly important. What is the bird flu? The bird flu is a disease caused by a family of flu viruses primarily transmitted between birds. Avian influenza viruses, the CDC and USDA say, are classified into two groups. Low pathogenic avian influenza, often seen in wild birds, and HPAI found mostly in domestic poultry, according to the CDC. LPAI viruses cause mild or no disease, and HPAI once caused severe disease and high mortality rates in infected birds. The bird flu has cost the government roughly $660 million and in recent times raised the price of eggs and poultry. At least 58 million birds were slaughtered last year due to limit the spread of the virus. Be sure to buy approved Eclipse glasses by Sybil Mays Osterman, USA Today. As the rush to grab a pair of Eclipse viewing glasses before they sell out ahead of the April 8th total solar eclipse heats up, experts so far have welcomed news for those worried about potential glass scams. We have not seen any glasses or heard of any glasses that are demonstrably unsafe, Rick Feinberg, the project manager of the Society's Solar Eclipse Task Force, told USA Today Network. Gazing at the bright rays from the eclipse without protective eyewear can cause serious damage to the retina of the eye, so wearing a pair of safe glasses is paramount. With online platforms like Amazon listing thousands of eclipse viewers, fears of fake or counterfeit glasses have grown. While Feinberg isn't worried about a flood of unsafe glasses on the market, some glasses for sale display false or misleading information on their packaging or design. We do see glasses coming from China that have printing on them that say they're made in the U.S. or that they are made by one of the American manufacturers. When in doubt, buyers should refer back to the list of official sellers and manufacturers maintained by the AAS, which communicates directly with sellers and manufacturers and checks test reports. Manufacturers need to have their glasses tested independently at two top labs in the U.S. to secure a spot. The list includes well-known North American manufacturers like American Paper Optics, as well as several larger grocery and retail chains in the U.S. like Walmart, Lowe's, and Kroger. NASA has also shared an easy method to vet eclipse glasses at home. Buyers should put on their glasses and look at a bright light like a flashlight. If their light is extremely dim or doesn't appear at all, the glasses are safe, said Susanna Darlings of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. In an instructional video, viewers should be able to see the filament of the light bulb, not the glow surrounding the bulb. Glasses can only be safely tested with a home light bulb and should never be tested with the sun. Eclipse glasses with scratches or damage are not safe to use. The current international standard for solar eclipse viewers, called ISO 12312-2, after the International Organization of Standardization, was adopted 9 years ago. Before 2015, there were a hodgepodge of standards for solar viewers. After gaining signatures from almost every country in the world, ISO 12312-2 became the global standard for safety for viewers, meant to be used for direct viewing of the sun. The new standard also changed NASA's official guidance, which previously insisted that the only safe way to observe an eclipse was through a pinhole projection or optical projection, no direct viewing at all. But problems with verifying the standard emerged in the lead up to the 2017 solar eclipse, and eclipse viewing supplies ran short. The market was suddenly flooded with Chinese manufactured eclipse viewers, primarily for sale on Amazon, that claimed on the label to be ISO certified without solid proof. Anybody can print that on anything, Feinberg said. It doesn't mean it's true. In the weeks before the eclipse, warnings of counterfeit eclipse glasses set off a panic that saw some people dump their glasses and miss out on the entire experience. Meanwhile, Amazon issued full refunds to customers who bought some eclipse glasses that the shipping giant determined were not up to industry standards. Feinberg got involved when a certified vendor reached out because Amazon had taken down its listings. I got this panicked phone call from a vendor I've known for years saying, all of our stuff just got pulled from Amazon and apparently they're pulling everybody, Feinberg recalled. Feinberg said he contacted Amazon directly and persuaded the company to put the products back up, but now he fears some vendors with sketchy documentation for their Eclipse glasses might have also ridden the wave and had their products relisted. Feinberg believes some vendors submitted documents as proof of certification to Amazon in the years since that look legitimate to an untrained eye, but are missing quantitative results of a safety test. He receives his own share of similarly fraudulent documents from manufacturers requesting a spot on the AAS list. Feinberg said countless sellers on Amazon don't provide evidence that their glasses come from an approved manufacturer, although many listings include the same pictures of the ISO 12312-2 test reports as manufacturers on the list. AAS surveyors have no way to tell. I'm still seeing people write in and say, I'd like to get on your list. Here's the certification from the manufacturer in China, and it's the same bogus report that I've seen 20 times already, he said. A spokesperson for Amazon told USA Today, we ensure our selection meets industry-accepted standards, and we develop innovative tools to prevent unsafe products from being listed. We continuously monitor our store, and if we discover a product was undetected by our automated checks, we address the issue immediately and refine our controls. In hindsight, alarm about the Chinese-made glasses might have been overstated. Testing after the fact revealed that the majority of the glasses, including from the Chinese manufacturers, seemed to be safe. We've seen a few slight outliers, he added. They fail to meet a standard by a small amount. Those tests led AAS regulators to relax their safety requirements ahead of this year's eclipse. Feinberg and two colleagues also submitted a proposal to loosen the international standards that he hopes to see passed by next year. Although the AAS hasn't encountered any severely faulty glasses, Feinberg still recommends against buying any old pair off of Amazon. There is no way for an ordinary citizen to confirm that Eclipse glasses are safe, he said. We have no reason to suspect that the stuff is unsafe, but we don't want to promote it without certainty. We've reached the end of our reading for today, Wednesday, March 27th, 2024, of the Cape Cod Times. Thanks for listening.